Right now, happy to welcome back to the show our guest who's joined us several times in the last year from the NAPFLA Community Foundation, where he is the CEO, Terrence Mulligan. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Barry. Good morning.
So we want to do a little bit of a year in review with you, and it's been since the fires of October, and even before that to a significant degree, the Community Foundation has taken on this new role in the community. So when you think back on 2018, what are your primary thoughts going to be?
Well, it's going to start with the fires, not surprisingly. 2018, even though the fires were out, you know, by the end of the month of October of 2017, the work at a community level continued well into calendar 18. In the last year and change, we have funded about 24 nonprofits to do various things to help people. And what many of your listeners may not know is that there are still, 8 to 10 of those nonprofits for whom disaster recovery, rebuilding is still a thing, is still part of their work day to day. It's still part of the work of the foundation. We have spent now a bit more than $7 million of the 16 and change that came in during the fires and the months that followed it. But the fires will be, I think, if you had to say what's the one story of 2018, that would be my lead. A couple of the things I would mention are the increasing public conversation about housing, and it's the lack of affordable housing for our workforce. That is a big story in 2018. Two other things that I would say are some concern among nonprofits at the future prospects for funding from the county of Napa. Many folks, if asked, would say, if you ask the question, well, who gives the most money to nonprofits in Napa County, they'd say the vintners. And the vintners do beautiful work, but the biggest funder of all is Napa County's Health and Human Services Department, which annually contracts out to nonprofits something like $15 to $18 million historically. And with the need for a new jail, with this sort of concern about property tax revenues post-fire, the word on the street is that some nonprofits are fearful of future funding levels being less robust than they've been in the past. The last thing I would say is when I reflect on 2018, I see it as a year in which nonprofits found their political voice. And I don't mean that they're involved in electoral politics. That's something that you absolutely cannot do as a public charity. But most folks may not know that you can do a lot of other things to influence the rules of the road and the policies that affect all of us at a local or state or even national level. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a lot of the work around advocating for more housing has been led by, and people at the table are folks from the nonprofit community. Similarly, with this issue of public charge, about which I'm happy to say more, a rule change proposed by the Trump administration that would have very negative effects on our community because we have many immigrant households that are members of our community who are already fearful and are not participating in programs that benefit their health and their children's health, to which they are lawfully entitled because of a confusion over what this public charge rule means. So you've seen nonprofits really sort of taking to the street to educate community members, to educate elected officials about the importance of those issues. The census is another one that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm proud to look back and see that nonprofits have really lifted their stature in a way to be more involved in public discourse because, you know, at the end of the day, nonprofits in California, there's a million people employed in nonprofits statewide. There's 75,000 nonprofits in the state, 600 in Napa County. We account for 15% of the state's gross domestic product. I think we're the fourth largest employer category. And too often, we're not involved in conversations that really bear on civic life and what policies make sense. And I think we should be.
Boy, there's a lot there, as I say, a lot to unpack from what you
indeed.
just delivered.
Or unwrap, as the season may,
unwrap. Let's talk about this public charge issue for a second. What you're talking about there is the proposal that if a person is receiving benefit from a social welfare program, a social safety net program, that they would then be disconnected from the process to gain citizenship?
Almost. almost, yes. And that's how I understood it to be until I heard someone really smart on this issue last week who said it's not about becoming a citizen. It's about becoming a lawful permanent resident.
Yeah. And so
it used to be that the public charge test basically meant if you're going to be a net drain on the public purse, if you're getting cash assistance, if you're getting TANF, if you're getting a particular kind of inpatient medical care that, you know, all of those read expensive, that may be a factor that works against you if you try to go from being a visitor to a legal permanent resident. The new rules would expand the list of things that might make you ineligible to include things like nutrition programs and well baby visits and other things that are about health, nutrition, housing programs, for example. And even though people who are already here, who are legal permanent residents or citizens or parts of families that are that may have mixed status, we're hearing that folks are disenrolling themselves from programs community health initiatives, which provides health insurance to something like 15,000 community members. There's these stories cropping up that if you talk to folks at Olay Health, for example, there's people who are reluctant to take advantage of the programs that make families more healthy because they don't understand that rule. And that's worrisome because that sort of thing affects the health of the whole community.
And the worry is that among immigrant families that if they're signed up for a program, if their name is on some documentation, that sets them up to be deported.
Right.
Pretty simple, right?
Exactly.
Imagine living under that fear.
Yeah, I can't hardly fathom it. I remember early in the new administration attending a meeting, probably with the sheriff and the chief of police and some community members. And at that time, when immigrant enforcement was on the up, and the fear around it was greater, it made me reflect on the post-earthquake time. In other words, there was a week or so there where I was hyper-vigilant. It's like, where's my flashlight? Where's my go bag? Similarly, in the fires. And it's like, well, imagine if that was every day in your life. The best advice that immigrant attorneys would give you is be prepared, have your stuff in order, just in case you get scooped up on the way to work. Your U.S. citizen children, you need an affidavit that says your citizen neighbor can take care of them. I mean, that kind of has to do with undocumented people, but nonetheless, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah, and the specter of being separated from your children, that's a new level of, there have been deportations, there have been INS sweeps for years where, we become accustomed to it.
Yeah.
But this whole new specter of families separated, that brings it home to people in a way it's never felt before, I think.
I for sure. And I think one reason I'm so proud of NAPA is that even, Anglo people in the community understand this. They understand that kind of palpable electric current of fear that is just beneath the surface here, and they're sympathetic to it. I mean, overwhelmingly, not everybody, of course, but overwhelmingly, they're sympathetic to that.
Yeah. So in what way in the coming year does that issue impact what your work is?
Well, it will affect it in the way that we still continue to fund a program that's helping people become citizens called the One Napa Valley Initiative, through which, as of August or so, 1,058 people over 5 years have become citizens. So we're at these tables with nonprofits who are day-to-day doing the work, and we're hearing these stories. So it will certainly color how we elect to have those folks spend their time. To paint with a broad brush, part of it means playing a little more defense instead of just playing offense. And so it means educating people on their rights, even as non-citizens, to be prepared to know what to do in the event that there's a ICE enforcement activity in the county, to be well-informed, to not fall prey to the rumor mill, which can have bad information in it. And that will almost certainly be part of the work of the foundation next year, this year.
I'm going to circle back for a second. How much did you say of the fire relief money has been dispersed?
About $7.2 million. So we did a big report on the anniversary in October, and at that time it was $6.2 million. $1.7 million of that amount was money that went to nonprofits to provide human services of different varieties. So everything from the urgent temporary shelter, meals, medical care, therapy, to longer term things like case management and carefully qualifying people for cash aid programs, legal assistance, help to understand their insurance. At that time, $4.2 million had gone out in the form of direct cash assistance to about 2,100 families, people who lost income, people who lost property, their homes. And the additional million that is now on the street is in that cash aid bucket, that latter bucket. So now the cash aid number is up to $5.2 million. I think as of last week, there were about 130 homeowners in Napa who had pulled permits to begin the long path of rebuilding. And I think we have helped somewhere between 35 and 50 of those 130 with fairly material cash assistance to cover the gap between, you know, what their insurance is going to give them and what it really costs to rebuild in a post-fire economy in the North Bay.
Yeah. Very interesting. What about all the rest of that money? What's the focus of it, and how long will you have that to disperse?
We see this as another sort of 2 to 4 years. And so there's three big categories of spending, the largest of which is continued rebuilding and healing. And so in that category, we're going to do things like continue to help homeowners who are underinsured rebuild. We're going to fund mental health services. I think I signed a check this week to Mentis, which has been a great partner in that regard. We're going to do things like support the long-term recovery case management, which is a thing that you need because certain people have really profound longer-term needs. Maybe they had no insurance at all. I understand there's about 60 families that are in that category right now that are getting actively supported that will need multiple kinds of, not just the foundation's money, but you know, the faith community and people who would volunteer to help them rebuild and all those sorts of things. So we anticipate spending between $6 and $8 million in the next 3 to 4 years in that category. The second category for us is economic recovery and the workforce, where one big idea is, gee, a lot of people are going to need to be swinging hammers in the North Bay to rebuild the 7,000 homes that we lost in the four counties where the fires blazed through. Why can't some of those people be our people? There isn't really a construction trades training program for youth in our community. And so we're thinking about trying to build one. And so we're starting some conversations in January around that. That could be sort of $1.5 to $2.5 million. Last would be future resiliency. Like, what can we do to make the community safer the next time? You know, maybe many years, but we only cut a break of really of a couple of years between the last grants that we sent out for the earthquake and the fires. And we did some things after the earthquake that really teed up the nonprofit sector to be a little more nimble in its response. And so we'll look for some things, if we have the luxury of some unspent money, to do for next time.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this question about county funding programs. I was under the impression that a lot of the Health and Human Services spending that comes from the county is state mandated, that there's the state money flows through the county and into these programs. So what kind of reductions are possible if a lot of it is mandated?
Well, the truth is, I don't know about the magnitude of potential cuts. I only know that I've heard from our nonprofit partners that they are concerned that if you sort of read the tea leaves and look forward, everybody thinks that the economy is due for a correction. And we know that property tax revenues are projected to be lower on account of the fires.
Sure.
And there's this big question of the jail, which could be, you know, will be spendy and will need support because we need, you know, the ballot measure for the jail, whenever that was, 2 years ago, didn't pass. And so I'm sorry to not have more particulars on that one, but I think that's just the sort of the feeling that we've had in talking to some of our nonprofit community organizations.
Yeah. And what's the timeline on how that plays out in the county's budgeting process?
Well, let's see. Does the county do a two-year budget or a one-year fiscal budget?
I think they're one year.
Many of the municipalities do a two-year go. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that by the time it's February, March, April, when we get into budget season, that we'll know more about what the shape and texture of potential reductions could be. But it's something that we want to pay attention to.
Yeah. And the housing topic. We already had a housing problem. Fires made it worse.
Yeah.
It's sort of brought into focus for a lot of people just how difficult the housing market is. What's on your plate in that regard? Do you have any plans in attacking the housing problem?
We do. In fact, when my board met last week, we approved about $100,000 worth of grants to basically do some spade work as it relates to accessory dwelling units or granny units. And here the idea is to provide consumers with some tools that will make the adoption of accessory dwelling units proceed more rapidly than would otherwise be the case. So, for example, we are going to borrow the consulting firm that did a beautiful job of this in San Mateo County and built a website that gives you the sort of, well, suppose I wanted to do this in the city of Calistoga. What are the ordinances? What are the setbacks? What are the particulars involved, including a handsome four-color workbook that we would print and distribute countywide? There would be a calculator tool on this website to say, okay, given the actual cost of construction post-fires in the North Bay, what am I looking at if I wanted to put a 500-square-foot thing in my backyard in Napa? A lot of the research around accessory dwelling units says, in effect, people love the idea, but they face barriers. Like, between the thought and the deed lies the shadow. It's complicated. Like, you know, I've never remodeled more than my kitchen, and that was not exactly a picnic.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever we can do to provide tools to consumers, we want to do. The second thing that we approved as part of this set of grants last week, it's actually hiring a consulting firm to do this work. So we get to do that because it's sometimes that's what we do is we give money to smart people who help us better at the work. The other thing that we'll do is we'll get all the municipalities together in both Napa County and Sonoma County. So we're approaching this in partnership with our sister community foundation in Sonoma to say, what are the best practices in this realm that we can lift up and encourage local jurisdictions to aspire to? So in Napa County, for example, I know the city of Napa has done quite a lot of good work to encourage people to create second units. Same is true in Sonoma County, where if you live in Sonoma County, you know, in the county, not a particular city, you can put up to three of these little beauties on your parcel, meaning you could convert your garage, you could do a junior accessory dwelling unit within the roof line of your home, and you could put a granny unit out back.
Wow.
And I'm not saying that's what we aspire to, but if you get policy folks in the room and have conversations about what might be, and you think of housing as a regional issue, which ultimately it is, since 44% of our labor force in commutes every day from places like Sonoma, Lake County, Solano, et cetera, we think there's some efficiencies to be gained there. And so we're really excited about housing overall, but pretty narrowly focused for the short term on this accessory dwelling unit idea, because in Napa County, boy, oh boy, is land expensive. This is now a by right proposition. You know, I got my little patch of heaven on Balfour Court in Napa. If I wanted to do this, there's nobody's going to file a CEQA lawsuit to stop me as long as I'm within the 5-foot setback and I'm below 1,200 square feet. And I think that is what appeals to us is that this could be a private citizen-led solution to a public crisis.
Yeah, and it's based on willingness. Nobody's going to force you to do it, but it's an option, and it has financial benefits for existing homeowners.
For sure.
All right. Helps to solve a problem. It might be a solution within families or within, you know, existing relationships, or, you know, for people you don't even know that you're helping.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think I'm a fan of the Gasser Foundation's beautiful work in housing, and they just, you know, they're have broken ground for Stoddard West, which when it comes online, and it's pretty soon, I think it's 2020, when it's done, done, there'll be 50 units of affordable housing in our community that weren't there a year ago, and that's beautiful. And it's also true that when you take HUD grants and state tax credits, it's pretty rule-bound and therefore pretty expensive. And so the price per doorknob of that beautiful project is $550,000. We think you can do ADUs for as little as $40,000 to sort of $250,000, yeah, which is
a different scenario.
A big difference.
Really good. Great information, and gives me a lot on my radar now for the coming year. We can have you back to talk about these things.
You betcha.
See how
happy
you're doing.
To do it anytime.
Terrence Mulligan from Napa Valley Community Foundation with an update on the foundation activities. Have a wonderful holiday in your little piece of heaven.
Thank you. You too, Barry.
Okay.